Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. Don't worry, I'm only here to introduce the episode. No monologues from me today. Without a doubt, you've already watched the documentary Murder Among the Mormons on Netflix, which is directed by Jared Hess and Tyler Meesom. And doubtless, you have all kinds of questions you'd like to ask the people who actually lived through the Mark Hoffman forgeries and murders. Well, lucky you! Sunstone gathered together some of the people who appeared on Murder Among the Mormons for a panel discussion just a few days after the documentary premiered, and we had a ton of fun getting the inside scoop from them. So, let's join Jimmy Rex as he introduces our panelists.
So yeah, it's a pleasure to be able to moderate this this panel. It's a special panel. And by the way, thank you all four of you for being on. It's a topic that obviously is very prominent in the news right now and something that you're all so very close to. I can only imagine the different emotions that you have with the movie coming out, being featured in the movie, and then also, you know, just talking about it and drumming up these experiences from so long ago. And so big thank you. It's we're all very excited to hear from you. So I'm just going to kind of give a brief, quick introduction. And then I'm going to go through and have each of you explain real quick who you are, what your relationship was to Mark Hoffman at that time, or the story itself. So first we have is Kurt Bench, and Kurt owns Benchmark Books. And for more than 40 years, they have been selling used, rare, out of print books here in Utah about Utah and Mormons and everything else. And next we have Sandra Tanner. She and her husband, Gerald, they co-founded the Utah Lighthouse Ministry. And they're married in 1959, converted to biblical Christianity. They continued researching the LDS history, and many know a lot about their story. They helped bring about many popular books, probably the most popular, The Changing World of Mormonism, which was published in 1980, and Mormonism, Shadow or Reality. And she and her husband, again, featured in the movie. We'll get to a lot of the questions with everybody, but I want to kind of, again, just give these quick backgrounds. Brent Ashworth, he's an autograph collector and dealer of U.S. historical documents. A lot of those related to Mormon history. He also has assisted greatly with the Glenn Beck Organization, the LDS Church History Library, and BYU. And then he, as well, and his family, they're just all sorts of different donations and different organizations they've worked with the church and outside the church. He also appeared on Glenn Beck's show about collecting in 2013 on Pawn Stars. He's just all things that have to do with collecting books. Brent is an expert. And Brent Metcalf, who has a long history as a bodyguard for the church. He was an assistant researcher at this time of the story. And anyway, rather than me kind of just read about this on each one, I'm going to have each one of you introduce yourselves quickly. Start with you, Kurt, and tell us what your relationship was to Mark Hoffman at that time.
Okay. At the time, I was working for Deseret Book Company, and I began the department that we call Deseret Book Finding Rare Books. And I had heard about Mark and wanted to meet him. Eventually we did meet, did a lot of business together. I thought we were good friends, did a lot of things socially as well. And along with everybody else, later found out he wasn't who we thought he was.
Awesome. Sandra?
Well, Gerald and I had a little bookstore in our front room at that time, and we sold our own pamphlets and writings and a few things by other people. But we were known in the community for our challenge to Mormon claims as ex-Mormons. And I think that Mark ran his first forgery by me, that Salt Lake Temple second anointing document that he then took up and sold to Jeff Simmons up at Utah State. But Mark came in at times through the years, and I didn't really know him as a personal friend or anything. Just he would come in and talk Mormon history with us at times.
Okay, great. And then Brent Ashworth?
Well, I was a criminal prosecutor right before I met Mark down in Price, and been an attorney graduate of the University of Utah. And a collector all my life. This is my 65th year and collecting autographs, documents. My kids collect dust, probably true. Collect about everything. Mark and I first met over a phone call in 1981, in which I asked him if he had any items of Joseph Smith, and he quoted to me a letter. And so we made a deal on the first phone call. I found the note of that years later when I was cleaning out my desk, which shows you how often I clean out my desk. And on it, he said it was, I said, where'd you get that? He says he got it from a large Texas collection, was not yet named. So we did a lot of business together over the years. Bud Willoughby, the chief of police then in Salt Lake, when he got a hold of me after the bombing, said, he asked me why I hadn't met with him on Wednesday, which was our usual time, our usual spot at Crossroads Mall at Walden Bookstore. And I told him about my wife keeping me from visiting that day. And he said, well, we need you back here. He says, you spent more time with him than his wife did the last 4 years, and we need your help on this case. I did not take that as a compliment at that time. Hoffman was their prime suspect. So that's an intro.
Awesome. Thank you, Brent. And Brent Metcalf.
After I left employment for the church, which was basically a termination and then allowed to resign, so forced resignation, in April of 1983, I met Mark Hoffman. And Steve Christensen had contacted me via Scott Kenny, who was publisher for Signature Books at the time. And he wanted to see if he could hire me to basically buy books and read them for him and then give him reviews of these books. And so I did that for some time. And then eventually I ended up on a Book of Abraham project. That project eventually ran out of funding. And then Mark Hoffman hired me to go and do research, genealogical research on the backgrounds and genealogies of certain prominent mission presidents to see if any of their descendants still retained any of the valuable books from the missions that they were in. Because in some cases, as Brent Ashworth, I'm sure, can attest, is that some of the foreign editions are worth more than some of the English editions of the Book of Mormon. And so that was basically what I was doing until the bombings occurred. And like Brent Ashworth, Mark Hoffman had actually called me the night of the two bombings, and he was going to pay me a paycheck. And he said, why don't we go to lunch tomorrow? Come by my house and we'll meet and then go out to lunch somewhere. So I went to his house and he wasn't there. And that's part of that story is told in the docuseries, but it's not quite complete because I actually went into Signature Books at that point, their office. And it was while I was there, a Tribune reporter called one of the workers there, and she told me that there was word of a third bombing, and it was a car bomb. And I said, what kind of car was it? And she said, it's a Toyota MR2. And I just came unglued. And, you know, I raced out. She told me it was over by the Deseret Gym, went straight over there. And that's where I was being talked to about someone trying to kill me by a Salt Lake City detective standing about 20 feet away from the bomb car. And so to say it was terrifying doesn't even begin to capture the experience.
Yeah, no, and we're going to get into a little bit more of that here as we get going. So thank you for that intro, Brent, as well. And then just because our audience comes all parts, there's active Mormons, fully believing Mormons, there's people that are sort of in the church, some that have left the church, all are part of this, you know, audience that's watching today. So just real quick, if you would, each, Kurt, we'll start with you. Just maybe tell us your current relationship to the church, is in regards to, you know, where you at with the church today.
Well, I can tell you that I'm not a general authority. And I can tell you for sure that I will not be. No, I'm an active church member and all my life. And I own a bookstore that specializes in books on or about Mormonism. In fact, maybe this is a shameless plug, but next month there'll be a second volume of the book, Why I Stay, published by Signature Books, and my story's in there. So, and there are a lot of other great stories to that effect by people on why they stay.
Great. No, thank you for sharing that. And Sandra?
Well, my husband and I are both from fifth generation Mormon families, but we had a faith crisis at the time we got married. And in our researching for that, we ended up writing and publishing and running a little bookstore, which is why we eventually met Mark Hoffman. So I've been the, I don't know what you'd call it, gadfly in the community, the thorn in the side of the church for 60 years.
There might be other names that people can think of for you, Sandra.
Well, Jezebel has been suggested.
Awesome. Thank you. And then Brent?
Which one?
Ashworth.
Well, I'm an active member of the church, always have been all my life. I've collected items belonging to the prophets of the church since I was a youngster, age 7. Started with Heber J. Grant. Wow. And in a box of things that my grandmother had saved. If anybody's interested in my story, this is my worthless plug. This is my book. And Kurt gave us a little attention on it a year or two ago.
What's it
but
called?
If you want to read my involvement with Hoffman, I've tried to cover it in Show and Tell.
Yeah, tell him the title, Brent.
It's called Show and Tell. Big surprise.
Awesome.
Called Show and Tell by Tracy Felstead, who was my biographer for it. And okay. Kurt was kind in letting us come and grace his lovely bookstore to put a plug in for it a couple of years ago. I have my own bookstore called B. Ashworth's. It's in downtown Provo, and we're pretty much open by appointment only right now due to the pandemic, but we seem to get people daily that want to come by. It's been a lot of fun, but yes, I'm an active believer, and I believe Joseph Smith was a prophet. You bet.
Thank you. Thank you. And then Brent Metcalf.
I was born and raised in the church, and then over time, I went through my own, what I would call a failure of faith as opposed to a crisis of faith, and ended up in a position of not really believing anymore. Then in 1984, as a result of the publication of the book I edited and contributed to, which was New Approaches to the Book of Mormon Explorations and Critical Methodology, in December of 1984, I was excommunicated.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, cool. So I want to start out just the series just came out.
I'm sorry. That was 1994.
Yes. 94. Yes. No worries. Wow. Thank you.
My technical advisor just on that.
There's going to be a quiz.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, in the story, it just came out. Obviously, you're all portrayed one way or another in the story. Just wanted to see first, and anybody can go first if you want to just kind of speak up. But what did you love about the way that they portrayed the story in the docuseries? And was there anything you wish they would have added or left out?
Maybe I could take a moment on that. I thought it was excellent. As an overview, I thought it was great. Obviously, the Hoffman story could go on for days. So they had to pick and choose. And I was impressed with how they did that. I learned something. I didn't know as much about Steve Christensen because I didn't have much to do with him. I think I had one phone call with him, and I was told that Hoffman tried to keep his main customer separated quite a bit. I did have a lot to do with Al Rust. Al helped me get started in collecting coins as a kid. I thought as an overview, it was very good. It was excellently done. I feel like we have a friendship with Tyler and the crew that was involved, Jared Hess, of course, and others. There were some gaping things left out. That shouldn't shock any of us here, but I thought one of the biggest things was the involvement of Lynn Jacobs, which I think was, I don't know that Lynn's name was even mentioned.
I don't think
so. He was, Lynn was the one that Mark had paid $10,000 to, evidently, to say he'd found the Salamander letter in a group of old letters back in where he was going to divinity school at Harvard in the Massachusetts area, where my wife and I later served a mission. And so when Hoffman first offered me the Salamander letter, I think he'd already offered it to President Hinckley. The price was higher. It was $50,000. And to me, it was $50,000. I told Mark, it was one of the few items I told Mark I thought was a forgery. I wish I could have said that about all the other things I bought from him. I can't. I bought a lot of things from him that I thought were genuine, the Lucy Mack Smith letter among them, and the other Martin Harris letter, the faithful letter about his testimony. It was in pencil, so it couldn't have been part of the case. There's no test for pencil, evidently, other than comparisons. I thought maybe Lynn's role in the case needed to be mentioned, because all of us thought for a while that it was Lynn that had discovered this letter. And before he died later in his life, I had a little to do with him. I sent him a little business and we talked about it. He really regretted that he got involved, hooked up with Mark on this thing. I think his story really didn't get told at all. And I think it was a big part of the Salamander story. But other than that, I thought these guys did a great job on a tremendously complicated story. Each one of our stories, we could go on for days. And I guess I did for a while. I heard this afternoon that Tyler told somebody, Rick Bennett, that he'd spent 8 hours with me that day going through things. And we told a lot of stories.
Well, it's interesting.
I listened last night and I felt bad that they couldn't put the Emily Dickinson story in, because that was kind of fun. Anyway, I've probably said too much, but
no, you're totally fine. Just want to give everybody a chance. But it's funny how, you know, a lot of people that thought it should be 2 hours, a lot of people thought it should be 6 hours. They talked about that last night. But what about anybody else have any thoughts as far as their feelings on the story after it came out?
Well, I was impressed that they got so much footage from the news channels from the time. I thought that really made it interesting. I assume probably the interviews with all of us could have pieced together all the same information, but it made it interesting to see it from news clippings at the time, from interviews. So I thought that was really a surprise and very good addition. Of course, selfishly, I was disappointed that they didn't give Gerald credit for coming out against Mark's Salamander letter a year before the murders.
Well, Sandra, I actually want to follow up with that. One of the first questions I had was actually from somebody named Devin Stanfield. And he said, you know, please ask Sandra, that they mentioned last night, the directors kind of mentioned briefly about that your husband, Gerald, was kind of the only one that was vocally against the Salamander letter as a forgery. And wanted to hear a little bit more about that, maybe how and why he thought that that was a forgery, and then what specifically led to those feelings.
Well, when Gerald first heard rumors about the Salamander letter, and I assume the rumors were started by Mark, but before he ever came out with photos of the document, the stories were spreading around amongst all of us that are interested in Mormon history about the letter. And so Gerald was all excited, assuming it would be true. So to prepare for when he hoped to see it, he had gone back and reread E.D. Howe's Mormonism Unveiled, and he had looked at a BYU Studies article about Joseph Knight and different sources like that to try to get a handle on remembering stuff about Martin Harris. So when he finally got a copy of the Harris letter, well, not a handwritten copy, but I mean a typed copy. And he went through it and he was so excited. He was all ready to do a messenger on this. And then he started picking up echoes of phrases from E.D. Howe and Joseph Knight article that appeared in this Salamander letter. And he told me, he says, I think somebody made this up using these other sources. And I said, Gerald, how do you know it wasn't the other way around? Maybe that's just the way everyone talked about things at the in the late 1800s, 1829. And I says, so Martin Harris tells different people the same story. Maybe that's why they all sound familiar. And he said, no, he said, I'm telling you, the Salamander letter came after E.D. Howe and Joseph Knight's, the article in BYU Studies. He says, I absolutely know it came after that. Okay. And he's going to go against every historian and scholar and test in the world. I said, Gerald, what do you know about anything? You know, I mean,
awesome.
But his was, it was the wording. It was all on the phrasing.
Okay. Thank you for getting, that was a question I had as I watched the documentary as well, was kind of what was it about it that he caught? Because so many people, so many leaders in the church, so many scholars and everybody else, I mean, were fooled by the forgery. Maybe Kurt, maybe you can touch on this a little bit. What looking back, why do you think Mark was able to be so effective and fool so many people, including yourself and you know, the other panel members?
Well, one of the ways he fooled everyone, Brent and I talked about this a little earlier privately, he was a master at compartmentalizing. He would tell one person or group one thing, but never tell everybody the same thing. And we thought if we could have gotten together as a group of us, a long time before everything literally blew up, we probably could have figured a lot of things out. But he was very good at keeping everybody apart and deceiving everyone on a personal basis, and then having a public persona that was different. So he was just so good at getting people's trust and then using that and turning it against them. And I didn't know anybody at the time. I didn't know what Gerald's feelings were but about him, but everybody I knew was impressed by him. He'd gotten good press. He was becoming kind of famous, and there was no reason that we knew of to not trust him. He was the genuine article to all of us for a long time.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that in regards to that was that no one knew how many documents he had floating out there. If all the document dealers would have known how many things he was trading, I think there would have been questions sooner.
Yeah, and Brent Ashworth, maybe you can speak to this because you were collecting so much. How rare was it for him to have so many different special documents? Did that set off any flags for you at all as you were collecting?
Well, obviously in hindsight, it should have. but no, it didn't. It didn't. There were actually genuine pieces that came up during that period. One of the best was the John Taylor Journal, which came my way. And I know I spent a lot of time on that with President Hinckley. And when that was announced, Mark was mad at me for the news media, the Tribune, I think, came out and said I got it from Mark, like the Lucy Mack. Mm-hmm. And he was quite proud of his product as I look back on it, because he didn't want that mixed it in with anything that he'd come up with.
Gotcha.
But yeah, that's, I don't know if I answered your question. But
yeah, no, that answers it well. And Brent Metcalf, a question for you. You could tell in the movie or in the docuseries, you know, you got a little bit emotional talking about how this affected you. I know your daughter, and she'd mentioned to me how this, you know, did affect you and your family and things like that. And I was just wondering, maybe a little bit looking back, what lessons you took out of this experience? What did it teach you about people in general, about God, and about yourself as far as, you know, after experiencing something like that with that kind of deception?
It was, I don't know how to put it. It was troubling to the core. I had the most difficult time trusting anyone at all for years. Even those who were closest to me, I didn't trust them to keep my confidences. I didn't trust them on any level. It was utterly devastating as far as that goes. And I don't think that most people who know me would even think that, because on the outside, I can kind of go along with people and, you know, be a part of the party if I'm there. But inside, this was constantly grinding at me. And as far as belief in God and everything, I already had come to the conclusion by the time of the bombings that I no longer really believed in a God. And it's interesting because I went to Steve's funeral and my dad came with me. And actually both parents did. And I just sobbed through almost the entire thing. It was one of the hardest things to get through. And then we went up to the grave site, which happened to be not far from where B.H. Roberts had been buried. And it was Marion D. Hanks was there. And he was talking to my dad. And he said to him, well, if this experience can help bring Brent back into the church, then maybe it will have had value. And I appreciated where he was coming from. And that within his mindset, he meant that in the kindest, most generous way possible. But then there was another part of me that was so deeply offended, because I felt like I would rather keep not believing and have Steve alive. I didn't need this type of object lesson to go back to my faith.
Yeah, it's a lot to put on you.
Yeah. And so, I guess that.
Tell them who Marion D. Hanks is.
Encapsulates it. Sure. I'm sorry, what was that?
Tell them who he was.
Marion D. Hanks.
D. Hanks was a general authority.
Right.
At the time. And he knew my dad. My dad, you know, was managing director of temples for the LDS Church. So he was basically, consider him the chief operating officer of all temples for the church. Gotcha. That's what my dad was. So, and so they knew each other well.
For maybe for Kurt and for you, Ashworth, being fully active members of the church, a lot of people's faith was rocked by the whole experience because of the deception where the apostles and prophet weren't able to discern, you know, the forgeries and things like that. Did it affect your testimony at all, or how did it affect your relationship with the church and your belief in the church at that time? Kurt, you can go first.
Okay. Well, I've heard this a lot, and I know it had a great effect on some people's faith. It did not have that effect on me, because the way I looked at it was Mark fooled everyone. And in the series, his own wife said he fooled me every day. So I don't attribute any supernatural powers to our general authorities. I mean, I believe they can be inspired, but I didn't think they should have any extra degree of this spirit of discernment as anybody else. And he did fool everyone. And so I cut them a lot of slack. But I do understand that it affected people who have this idea that the general authorities can't be deceived. They can be, and Ballin Oaks said that, and that they preferred to trust people unless they were given a reason not to. And that's the way I looked at it as well.
And Brent Ashworth, how about you?
Well, I had one thing that helped me was a visit I had the day after Mark went to prison. I was given a call by President Hinckley's secretary if I wouldn't mind coming up, and I thought maybe he was assembling a group of people to talk about what they could have done differently, you know, with the church or whatever. But instead of that, he spent about 20 minutes kind of shooting himself down in front of me. And I'd never seen that from him before. He was always very positive. He said, "I don't know what else we could have done, Brent." He said, "You know, these letters even went to the FBI lab, a couple of them, and they authenticated them, and they mentioned the cyclotron test at the University of California at Davis." And it wasn't but a week later that I remember that was Mark that had told me about that. I'd forgotten where I'd heard that term before. Mm-hmm. But at one point, President Hinckley looked at me and he said, "You know, I know the prophet Joseph Smith by his writings and so on very well. And I believe that. I don't know of another church leader that I ever met that knew church history like Gordon B. Hinckley." He loved church history. We spent an hour and a half on the John Taylor Journal one day. Anyway, the point was that he looked at me and he said, "He even had the prophet's center sentence structure down." And he quoted one little thing on that. And at that point, I felt like I could say something. I'd just been listening to him for about 20 minutes. And I said, "Yeah, President, it's kind of like the guy was possessed," speaking of Mark. And I remember he looked right at me and he gently tapped his desk and he said, "Well, he was possessed." Kind of like, "Are you just picking up on this now?" To me, that answered the entire Hoffman thing. And I would tell people that have questioned prophets. Prophets have been deceived or attempted to be deceived throughout the Bible, throughout all of our history at one time or another. There are a lot of great examples of that, Moses being a particular one that jumps out. I think Judas Iscariot was trying to deceive the Lord, and he was the only one that was not deceived. He knew exactly what Judas was up to. So to me, it's not a matter of faith. In fact, if anything else, it strengthened my faith that yes, prophets are men, but they have special callings.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that take on it. Well, and this is open question to whoever wants to answer it, but Scott Barrett asks, "How has the Hoffman episode affected the field of Mormon studies as a scholar, both for the negative and for the positive? Like, what lessons have scholars learned in how they approach Mormon studies?"
Well, I can tell you right now, I have several friends who are intimately involved in the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And I think it has absolutely brought to the forefront the need for very critical and detailed examination of every single document, establishing provenance, knowing what the paper is, knowing what the ink is, all of those details. And so I think it's been a clarion call to scholars: don't take anything for granted.
Yeah, anybody else want to touch on that?
Well, there certainly is a new standard of scholarship. And that's a perfect example is the Joseph Smith Papers. And they go to as many sources as they can to verify and to document. They don't just read one entry in a journal and call it good. It's much more meticulous now. And now I'm not aware of them doing tests on anything. I get asked that, are all documents physically tested now? Not to my knowledge, and certainly not in the document trade, but you do pay a lot of attention to provenance and where things come from. You check out the story, you try to line up as many things as you can, but I don't know that the church is testing all these things.
Yeah. There are a number of documents, though, that have been tested. For example, the Anton transcript is a good example. They tested both the paper and the ink on it. And so there, and I'm talking about the characters document, not the one that Hoffman created.
I was going to say.
So, yeah, just to clarify that. And they tested both the paper and the ink on it. And so there are some documents like that where they have gone to that level of scrutiny in examining it. But I think that Kurt is right. In some instances where they know that they've had a document in their archives for well over 100 years. And, you know, there's no reason to go to that extent. in those cases because they've established such a rock solid provenance. But in some cases, they have dug very, very deeply.
Well, gotcha. I can talk to that a little because I'm still working with a Joseph Smith papers project. And I was asked to bring a Joseph Smith piece up during the pandemic just a few months ago. And there were a team of people that greeted me, the Church History Library, with a lot of questions. I had a holograph of Joseph Smith, which they hadn't put into the Joseph Smith Papers Project. After an hour of looking at it with people there and learning more of its provenance, genealogy, history, they agreed that it should have been included some time back. Yes, they're a lot more careful now than they were. And in fact, I've got a first edition Book of Mormon they're going through right now, looking at handwritings. And there was a whole litany of questions about provenance when it was taken in. So I think they're careful. Hoffman took me into the vault of the church historian in the old days. And we got to see about everything he wanted to pull out. I wasn't treated that way after Hoffman went to prison. the archives, but literally the church historian's office was shut down to me for years after that. And I could have been resentful. I was not, because I understood from my own damage, I'd lost hundreds of thousands of dollars to Hoffman and the things I'd bought, that the church had to be more careful, that we had to be more careful. The next time I went in, there were cameras installed. There were glass walls where there hadn't been. And then I served two missions up there at the old archives and then the Church History Library over a period of about 7 years. And you bet, security is one huge change from Hoffman's days.
Wow. Yeah. Well, so I want to go back a little bit to the documentary itself. Scott Barrett asked, and this can be for anybody can answer this, maybe Brent Metcalf, if you want to start, but what contact have you had with the Christensen and Sheets families, if any, especially since the release of the movie? And can maybe tell us a story, a quick story, that would talk about the goodness of Steve Christensen or Kathy Sheets, or maybe something that we wouldn't have heard from the documentary.
Oh, geez. There are a lot. I can tell you one right now that Steve was not your typical bishop when he was a bishop. So he had a special event he would do where he would get all of the single sisters in the ward and take them all out to a nice restaurant, pay for it, the entire thing. And just take him out. And this was a regular bishop single sisters date that he would hold all the time. But then a really good example of how unorthodox he could be at times. There was an occasion where he could tell that the priest quorum in his ward was kind of struggling with just sitting through sacrament meeting. So what he did is he got them all together and they skipped sacrament meeting and went to Dairy Queen to get ice cream.
I would have liked this guy.
And so yeah, so he spent the church time with those young men to let them know what you feel and what you're experiencing matters more than me sitting there watching you go through church and struggling with it and not really understanding even what's going on. And that was Steve. He was, you know, just as kind and as generous as can be imagined.
Wow, thank you for that story. Anybody else have one? Kurt, maybe something that you had experience with them?
Well, he was a very generous person, as Brent just said, but I remember I sold him a lot of books. And he bought, when the Wilford Woodruff journals first came out, I mean, they weren't cheap, several hundred dollars. And he bought several sets so that he could give them away and just gave them to people who wouldn't have been able to afford them otherwise. So that to me was quite generous, and he ended up donating a lot of his library. Everything I ever saw about him was he just exuded kindness and generosity and thoughtfulness.
Thank you. Sandra, did you have any personal relationship with either of them?
No, I never met either one of them.
Gotcha. Okay, perfect. And going back to Brent Ashworth and Brent Metcalf, you two are essentially the two that are identified in the docuseries as the two potential people that Third Bomb was meant for. It sounds like Brent Ashworth, you had that appointment to go and meet with him that day, and you said that your wife had told you she didn't have a good feeling about it. Somebody had mentioned in a previous podcast that you did meet up, but you didn't go to the car. Can you just kind of tell us a little bit more about that day, maybe both of you, and what that, what the experience of knowing that you were that close to being part of this tragedy, maybe just kind of walk us through how that made you feel, or that experience of having that in your life. And Brent Ashworth, you can go first.
You go first. Okay. Mark and I met normally about 2:15, 2:30 on Wednesday's afternoon. I usually went by his home in the morning. He'd bait me with something, and we would meet at our spot, quote unquote. That was our spot, was Walden Book. That particular day, as I mentioned on the Netflix, my wife had feelings that I shouldn't go up there, and I listened to her. And when Chief of Police Bud Willoughby called me on that a couple days later, I remembered that, and I said, well, my wife kept me from going up. And he said, probably good you listened to your wife. Well, what turned out was that Hoffman went to our spot. Time dating was just coming in 1985. He had a time dated receipt for a 50-cent Wall Street Journal that he picked up waiting for me at Walden Book. And we know that that was in his pocket after he's blown up. And it was dated less than 8 minutes. He had just enough time to walk from the spot he was to meet me up to getting into his car and getting blown up. So that's why I was never able to disqualify myself as a potential target, although it's certainly not any honor I want to have. But the problem was that George Throckmorton corrected me in a BYU book collecting conference in 2015. We were asked to put on a conference on Mark Hoffman, and we had three segments. And first one, I got up and I got asked that question, and I said, well, like I did on the film back in the old days, I don't know if he was trying to kill me, but I haven't been able to eliminate myself as a possible target. And George got up and he says, oh yeah, he was trying to kill you. He says, we had evidence we were following him that day. We had evidence of people, and he didn't give me all the ins and out, but he's been very frank with me about it. I still don't know. I don't care. I don't care to know, but I haven't been able to remove myself as a target. He was at our spot when we were to meet. I'm grateful that I listened to my wife and didn't go up there, as the chief said. That's about all I know about it.
You think when you didn't show up, do you think he then had to figure out how to get the bomb out of there?
Because I think he
accidentally went off, or do you think he did it on purpose?
No, I think it was accidental. I think George and mostly the ATF could tell you exactly where a bomb goes off. And as we all know, Mark lied to Jerry Taylor from the ATF as soon as he came out of his semi-coma or wherever he was at the hospital. Jerry said he'd flown in from San Francisco. He says, I want to be the first to talk with him. And Mark said that the box had been on the dashboard, and when he opened the door, it had fallen down and blown him up. But ATF said, no, it didn't go off there. It went off. In fact, the only part of the car that wasn't destroyed was that bottom of that door frame on the front. They could tell exactly where the bomb went off. He was trying to move it to the back seat, but as George put it, he hit the gear shift. And in the process, he set it off.
Wow, gotcha.
Clearly an accidental, you know.
Yeah, at the preliminary hearing, were you at that, Brent Ashworth?
Yeah, I was the last witness. Our son was in the hospital then. So they put me off till the last witness before the I was one of three people that Hoffman mentioned he wanted to kill with the first bomb, me and Tom Wilding and Steve Christensen. And
it was fascinating at the preliminary hearing how the forensics guys traced back and showed how where all the shrapnel had to come from. And that's how they figured out where it was at the console.
I can tell you exactly where it went off, and they knew Hoffman was lying. And what I heard was that Jerry Taylor told the police and the investigators that night, says, "Well, there's your bomber. Now prove your case."
right, because when he got to the hospital, he had told them, as I recall this, he told them he had got in and sat down in the car. And they knew from his injuries, he couldn't have sat down, that he had to have the door open and he had to be kneeling on the seat to be thrown across the street.
He had his right hip on the seat. He had his two feet on the pavement, the police told me. And he was reaching in like this, the eyewitnesses said, when the thing went off.
Right.
Gotcha. Thank you. And Brent Metcalf, any, want to add anything to that?
Well, going back to your original question, Market called me the night before, after the two bombings, and he's just talking to me on the phone, just pretty regularly, but he's just going, "Can you believe what's happening?" And I'm like, "No, this is insane," you know? And we were actually supposed to meet, I believe, that day. And so he said, "Well, why don't we get together tomorrow for lunch? And then we get, you know, I can pay you, we'll take care of that," so on. And so I went out to his house and he wasn't there. I think that Brent, you know, probably was his target at that point. Mm-hmm. But it's like he said in those tapes that you were listening to, that he didn't know who it was going to be. It could have been any of his associates, right?
Yeah.
Can I just mention one other thing I left out? Because I think it's critical to this. That is that after Steve was blown up and it was announced on the news, Mark called my home trying to find us. And I was not there. My wife picked up the phone and he asked for me. And she said, "Well, he's already left for work." And he says, "Well, have you heard the news?" And she says, "What news?" "Well, Steve Christensen has just been murdered." He used the word murdered. And so we passed that along to the police. That was had to be one of his first calls after, because they hadn't announced Kathy been blown up yet. I'd also mention this, and that is that Hoffman and I had a big deal going. It was probably bigger than Al Russ at the time. It was for $435,000. In fact, when I got the Hoffman papers later, I found that Mark had written out the deal twice, listing the items he was trying to buy back, which were mostly the Lucy Mac and a number of things that I got from him over the years. I think I was out doing dog and pony shows all the time. The church was putting theirs away. I think he was concerned that somebody might look at them a little more carefully. I don't know. But at any rate, we had a big deal going. We'd sat in his little MR2 where he'd doubled the amount that he'd offered me, from a quarter of a million to a half a million nearly, for these eight items. And I was putting a lot of pressure on him because he said he was going to come up with $50,000 to pay it, make a down payment. And of course he didn't. But he came to he wrote me a phony check, and he came by my home the night before the bombs went off. I don't know how many of you are aware of this. He came to our home, and I was so angry at him because this check had bounced, and I told him I would never accept another check from him. But I did. He talked me into it. The check bounced, and he was there. He came, his little family was in their van up front of our home in Provo that night. And when my son Matt came in and says, I was downstairs, and incidentally, I was a bishop then too, as was Gary Sheets, as was Steve Christensen. As my son came in, he said, Mark Hoffman's at the front door, Dad. I was so angry, I was going to really let Mark have it. And I came up the stairs, and I got about halfway up the stairs. And I don't know if I can say this here, but I'm going to tell you that I heard a voice. It was an impression, a voice, or whatever you might want to call it, that told me not to jerk with him that day, not to jerk him around. And I was so angry still that I got to the top step. I've gone up and down those steps many times since. And I couldn't say a thing. It was kind of like, you know, I'd like to kill you, Mark, but I don't dare to do anything. I couldn't say a word. Mark came in the house. He said, I know I gave you a phony check. I'll give you a good one. Find me a pen. So I went and got him a pen. He wrote the check for the wrong amount, the lesser amount than what he owed me. And I said, at that point, Mark, we both know that's not the right amount. He says, oh, yeah, well, let me correct that. So he wrote another check. And he said, you're not too talkative tonight. And he headed out the door. And I don't know why I said this as he went down the steps, but I said, Mark, this check's good, isn't it? I knew it wasn't, but that's what I said to him. That was the night before the bombs went off.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that story. Actually, one of the questions we had that I would like to touch on is does anybody else have a story, maybe a fascinating story from that time that wasn't shared in the documentary, or maybe you haven't shared too much that you would be able to share with us? I think everybody has a lot of interest in hearing stories like that one. So if anybody has
something. I've got a quick one. There's so much they couldn't fit in, obviously. I can only imagine the probably 90 some percent of the film went on the cutting room floor. But the day of the bombings, I had the dubious honor, I guess, of having been the one to call Mark to warn him to get his family out of the house because Steve Christensen had just been killed, and he sounded genuinely shocked. The weird part was, these guys know you couldn't ever reach Mark by phone. You had to leave a message, or you might get Dory, but I mean, he was always in control of that. And so I left a message right after I learned that Steve had been killed. And I said, Mark, this is Kurt. Call me, it's an emergency. And he called me back a couple of minutes later, and he said, hi, it's Mark. He says, you said it's an emergency, but with you, everything's an emergency. And he kind of chuckled. And looking back, I thought, how chilling that he could have a humorous response after he had just killed somebody and planted the bomb for someone else to be killed. It was horrendous.
Wow, it speaks to just how deceitful he was able to be.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this, that during the interview with me, this was a part that they couldn't add. They actually asked me, have you forgiven Mark? Mm. And I said, there's no one to forgive. The Mark Hoffman I knew never existed. So who do I forgive? Some fictional character? There's no one for me to forgive. And that's literally what I feel like after knowing him as well as I did and seeing the level of deceit that he brought to everyone around him, everybody here. And I feel like the Mark Hoffman that I knew was a chimera. He didn't exist. He wasn't even real.
A lot of truth to that, Brent.
Thank you. Sandra, what about you? Anything that sticks out from that time or anything that you want to share?
Well, when Gerald questioned Mark's document and I took those flyers up to Sunstone the year before the bombings, challenging his documents, I mean, it never occurred to me Mark was a psychopathic potential killer, but it was just a question of the documents. And so the next day, here comes Mark to the bookstore, and Gerald wasn't in the house at the time, and he says to me, Sandra, You of all people, how could you guys question my documents? Why would you want to start this problem with getting all this historical material out there? And I said, well, Mark, it doesn't sound like you can tell us where anything came from. And so we had this big discussion. And then he puts on his sales routine about, oh, but I'm about to get the Thomas Bullock collection and you're questioning my documents. Is going to make people leery of doing business with me. And you of all people would want me to get this Thomas Bullock collection because it has all this Brigham Young finances that'll really embarrass the church. So you guys ought to just really lay low on this because it's going to interfere with this business deal. And so he goes, boy, I guess I was a sucker. So I'm buying this whole big story. And Gerald comes home and I tell him about Mark's visit. And Mark says, Gerald says, he's conning you. But he was a very good salesman. He knew how to be persuasive.
Yeah. A follow-up question that I had for you, Sandra, Nan Wilson asked this is, I'm curious if the motivation to create the Mormon forgeries was to bring down the church or if that was just a collateral occurrence. He created so many forgeries. What did you feel like? Do you feel like he was doing it as like a vengeful thing towards the church? Because those documents, obviously, it talked about in the documentary, he was next going to bring about the lost pages of the Book of Mormon and everything else. Or do you think that was just a collateral occurrence?
I'm assuming the ideas for what he was doing gradually grew. We know in 78, he had that first anointing temple document. And so that would be worth a little money if, it had a historic interest, but it had nothing to do with the kind of later scenario he was dealing with Martin Harris. He was setting up a scenario with Harris to provide the church with all of the handwriting of Martin Harris from his documents so that he keeps building this trust that the church has samples of Martin Harris's handwriting so that he seems at some point of coming up with this idea of doing 116 pages. And he has to build into his documents the handwriting to eventually prove his 116 page. I don't know, he'd do all 116 pages. He'd only have to do a few pages in the middle or something and claim it was part of that. But then the church would use his documents to prove the handwriting of Martin Harris. But I don't think he started with the Martin Harris idea, but somewhere along the line, this scheme opened up to him.
Gotcha.
And can I add something now? Yeah,
please do, Kurt. And so then
in the film, when he's talking to the parole board, if you remember, he says, I wasn't trying to change church history. And then he said, well, let me correct that, or let me say that maybe I was. So I think he definitely wanted to change the whole trajectory of church history, and he wanted to bring as much damage, I think, to the LDS church that he could. I even admitted it.
Yeah. Brent Ashworth, you had something.
Well, I was just going to say that too long a story to tell here, but I'll just say that I got a call from Jay Todd, the editor of The Ensign in 84, saying, I heard that Mark Hoffman found the lost manuscript. That he's taken it over to the Tanners, that they're going to publish it. I don't know if Sandra remembers this, but I came over and asked her and Gerald if they had it. They said, no, I couldn't get a hold of Mark. Finally got a hold of him. And he said, oh, I think it's authentic. That's what he said at first. And then a couple days later, in fact, he even showed me some flight tickets to Bakersfield. He was flying to Bakersfield to pick it up. And it was a descendant from one of the Mormonism Unveiled guys that was quoted in there. I forget the name now. Pierce. That was it. Squire Pierce. Yeah. And any rate, when he came back, I was so excited about it. And Jay Todd said, we've heard he's got this. Can you find out anything about it? And so I felt like I was on a bit of a mission for the church on this 116-page story at the time. And I confronted Hoffman with it. And he said, oh, when he came back, he says, oh, I thought it was real, but it was just a fake. I said, what do you mean it was a fake? And he says, well, it was For one thing, it was only 60 and a half pages long. It wasn't 116. And I kept pressuring him on it. I think it made him really uncomfortable with it. Hope I did. And I said, well, gee, Mark, you know, the collector in me was getting to me at that point. I says, I can't imagine anybody spending that time drawing up 60 and a half page fake of the 116 lost manuscript pages. I says, what do you think we could get it for? I'd like to add it to my collection. He says, oh, I'll bet they'd ask $5,000 for the fake. That was more money at the time. And I says, look, Mark, if you can get me that, I'll give you $10,000. That's how serious I was about it. I went back to Jay Todd and I told him the story, and there was this kind of long pause, and he says, I hope you don't expect us to pay that, Brent. I said, oh no, I did that on my own. I couldn't get anything but an outline, 60 and a half page outline out of him, which we found during the time that I was working with the police, on the Hoffman case, but it's kind of interesting.
It was such a fascinating time with so much excitement around all these documents. It would have been interesting to be a part of that. I mean, I can only imagine the thrill when you keep hearing about these different special documents becoming available. I can see him getting swept up in it and thinking to himself, you probably gave him the idea when you said who would ever write out 60 pages. And he said, oh, I could get a lot of money for that. But is it still the same? Is there the same excitement around these documents? And is there, has there been some pretty cool discoveries, or what does the whole thing look like now as far as the hobby goes? And are these forgeries of Mark Hoffman, is there for sale? Are these worth a lot of, I'm guessing they're worth a lot of money today if you can get your hands on some of these. If you maybe speak on that, Kurt, and whoever else wants to.
Well, the standing joke in the trade is finding a genuine Mark Hoffman forgery. There's plenty of them out there. Mormon documents have always been a limited market. And, you know, Brent has been a collector for, I don't know, probably longer than I've been alive. Just kidding, Brent. He knows the market, but I know my market, and people are more careful now. There's still a very limited interest overall. You know, you just don't sell that many documents. People are trying to be more careful. There was a lot of suspicion for a long time, a lot of hesitance to have anything to do with documents, and it's gradually come back. But I don't think, and Brent could speak to this nationally and internationally, I think that was just a blip on the radar. I think it's as robust as ever, isn't it, Brent?
Yeah, I like to tell people I've been trying to build a market in this stuff for 35 years. I've got the mother load of it. After the Hoffman thing, I went around the country picking up as many Hoffman forgeries as I could. And Shannon sold me his stuff early on. He didn't have a lot, but I got some stuff. Rick Grunder had a big collection. I bought all of Al Russ stuff I get my hands on. So what do I do with all this stuff? Well, I ended up giving about 15 containers of it to the church after Rick Turley begged me for it. I've still got plenty of it. I keep trying to make a market in his stuff because I'm determined to get some of my money
you're
back.
About to get one. I think if ever there was going to be one, now would be the time. We've been going about an hour. We'll ask one or two more questions if you guys are okay on time, but just kind of wrap this up. But first question I wanted to ask, and we'll go in order, maybe, I don't know, whoever wants to speak first on this, but it's been, 35 years now. Have any of you had contact with Mark since the trial, since he went to jail? And if not, have any of you desired to have any conversation with him, and what would you want to talk about?
Well, I can go first. I haven't talked to him. I haven't tried to talk to him. I would like to know a lot more about what he did, but I could never trust him to tell me the truth. And that's the problem with talking to him. I don't know that you would come away feeling your questions were really answered.
Yeah. Thank you. Anybody else?
Well, both questions, no and no. And it's pretty simple. I have no interest in talking to him. And like Sandra said, I wouldn't believe him if I did talk to him. Tyler had said that for the docuseries that they had tried numerous times, to contact him and engage him. And I said, I'm glad you didn't, because you could never believe what he was telling you.
Yeah.
And it's just not worth it. I have zero interest.
Well, after what he did, after he killed two innocent people, I had no desire to have anything to do with him. In fact, I didn't even want to have anything to do with his forgeries, even as a marketable product for for a lot of years. And I really haven't done much, because it's just too, what he did was so horrendous, right, that I wouldn't want to give him any kind of support whatsoever.
Yeah.
By going to see him or anything.
Yeah. Maybe I can just say that I don't want to say much more than this, but our son was involved in a terrible accident about this time and was in the hospital, and he passed away on a Friday before I testified on the witness stand on Wednesday, and we buried our son on Friday.
Yeah.
And all I will say is that it was a very difficult time for me and for my wife and our family. And it's something that we've spent the last 35 years trying to move away from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, and we'll end it with that, kind of falls into my last question for each of you. And if, we'll just start with you, Kurt. We'll go through the
okay
of you. But so how has the release of the documentary affected you and your family in regards to just the attention that it's caused, or maybe the feelings that it's brought up? And what do you kind of hope the documentary does going forward for both people in and out of the church as they watch it?
Well, there's a lot of buzz about it, and Netflix is huge. The production was excellent. Everybody I've talked to has been impressed with just how well made it was, how balanced. Yeah, I've had a flurry, I'm sure we all have, of texts and emails and phone calls, and there's a lot of talk about it. And my kids are hearing from people, you know, friends their age that either didn't know much about it, or, you know, they just, oh, your dad was involved with that. So there's a lot of that. So I think it's a mixed bag. It's, you know, I have mixed feelings about it, because it makes us all revisit these terrible events and horrible memories. And yet, if it raises awareness, if it makes us more careful, if it makes us more studious about our history, then I think it's all worth it. And it's worth it to know what one person can do when he's focused on doing things to harm other people. It's a very telling lesson, and I think it's one we all need to remember.
Thank you. Sandra?
Yeah, I've gotten phone calls and texts from people that had no idea that I was going to be in this film, and they were just watching Netflix and what, who? And they call me up and they say, Sandra, really? How did you get in this? So it's been funny. At 35 years ago, how many people had no knowledge even of the Mark Hoffman incident? So
yeah, I was surprised. Audience. I was surprised at how few people is, because I posted it on my, you know, Instagram story that I was going to be moderating this panel. And I was shocked how many active members of the church had never heard of Mark Hoffman or this whole thing. I was actually really surprised by that. But Brent, maybe you can tell us about your experience. Ashworth?
Well, I was so enamored by the documents, and especially when I got the Lucy Mack Smith letter, because the church thought for 3.5 years that was its earliest dated document. And I was doing firesides from Maryland to California. I did 5 firesides in Utah on one Sunday, starting at Tremont and ending up with at a relief sighting meeting, and ending up with a stake priesthood meeting in St. George that day. I did hundreds of them. I made thousands of copies on goldenrod paper of the Lucy Mack Smith letter, which were passed out dutifully at the end of each thing and each meeting. And I thought, I'll never own anything as valuable as important as this is. Well, I've still got a brother-in-law to this day that claims that's an authentic letter, even though we know it's not.
Yeah.
The point is that I learned something from that experience, and that is that the only things that are really valuable in life are not the things you collect, even though that's what I still do. I love history. It's the relationships we have. And that's the most meaningful thing we have. And I guess the joke that Kurt and I used to always say is that Hoffman would say he'd take care of his friends. Well, I guess he did take care of his friends, right, Kurt?
Yeah, he sure
did. The point is that we don't want to forget that. I think we need to learn something from that. I don't look the other direction when somebody lies to me or tries to deceive me anymore. The end does not justify the means. No matter how valuable the document is, if the courier of that is a liar and a cheat, stay away from him.
Thank you, Brent. And Brent Metcalf, will end with you.
As far as the impact of the docuseries, like everybody else, I've had tons of text messages and, you know, private messages on Facebook and emails and everything else. And it's hard to keep up with at times, quite honestly. But the most important to me response has been from my family. And I'm talking about my kids were very proud of what I had done. But my extended family, the vast majority of whom are still very active LDS, they were very impressed and happy with it and thought, oh my gosh, you know, this was fantastic. And that meant a lot to me, because I think the objective that Jared and Tyler had was just to present the story, not to try and put some type of spin on it, you know, in one direction or another, but to allow the people who were involved to allow them to narrate the story. And I think they did a masterful job of it.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, I would agree as well. I think, you know, there definitely wasn't any kind of angle to the docuseries as opposed to just telling the story and letting you who were there and a part of it actually let that story play out. So, well, thank all of you. Such a pleasure to be able to moderate this. Thank you for giving me your time tonight. I know everybody was very curious to get some follow-up questions and to hear more of the story. It's truly a fascinating part of Utah and Mormon history, and you guys all being right in the middle of it. I'm honored to be able to moderate this panel and just want to say thank you again. And for those listening, please remember to donate to Sunstone. They're the ones that put this together, put a lot of effort so that we could get these amazing guests, the people that were literally in the middle of the entire story the entire time. So thank you again, all. And that'll end it for the evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.